Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a monthly glide through the clouds and wonder of arts and culture in Birmingham and beyond. In this programme, we consider borders, barriers and identity as we delve into a vibrant snapshot of European culture at the Bee Festival at the Rep. We take the plunge into the fascinating immersive theatre performance experience that is British Enough from Foolish People, and we look at the future before it's even made in the way of a new exhibition at MAC Birmingham. Already 6 shows in, if you'd like to catch up on our series archive and all the links relating to the shows so far, check out our blog, www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. Bee Festival is a local wonder, freshly mixing arts, music, theatre and performance, and fastly becoming a firm fixture in the second city. I caught up with one of its co-directors, Miguel Lianthan, to help get a handle of this year's theme and the new light that's been cast on our place on the world map. So I'm hiding out at the back of the Rep as part of the Bee Festival with Miguel Lianthan, and as we were just discussing, my Spanish, particularly my kind of Basque Spanish, isn't great.
Oh no, I think it's wonderful.
But you were telling me your surname means kind of means echo.
It does, yeah.
Which is massively appropriate for where we are. So people listening will think, where are they? Hiding out somewhere, you know, kind of in a vault. But we'll persevere. And we're here because it's very excitingly the 8th Bee Festival.
That's all right, yeah.
So if people don't know Bee Festival, Bee is kind of an acronym, if you like, for Birmingham Europe, European?
That's correct,
Birmingham,
yeah.
European?
Birmingham European Festival, it's also, you know, a word on its own, and we would encourage everyone who listens to this radio program to be there next year.
That's very clever, isn't it? That's a very clever play on words. And you've got quite an impressive lineup, where you've had so far. We're sort of, I suppose we're coming sort of midpoint in the festival now. Quite an impressive lineup of artists, performers, from across Europe, really. That's sort of built over the years to, I suppose there's a theme in some of the, about sort of crossing boundaries and sort of breaking down barriers, if you like. So I'm quite interested to explore that. And that's sort of been thrown into a new light this year, particularly in relation to something that happened last year, which is the whole referendum on our membership, the UK membership of the European Union. So
yeah, absolutely. The whole idea of the festival was to create a space, a communal space, for artists and audiences from across Europe to meet and experience art coming from all corners of Europe, and to get everyone's opinions and everyone has a chance to talk and discuss about the art and the Europe we want to create together. So post-Brexit and the result of it, it feels that the festival is more relevant than ever. Not only to try to seduce Eurosceptics that another Europe is possible, but also to celebrate the one we have, which has many downfalls, of course, but has also a lot of positive things. And just to be here and share dinner with someone you haven't met from a different country and talk about a piece you've seen together, that theatrical and cathartic experience of watching something together can break some borders. So that's the purpose of it.
And what's fascinating to me about that dialogue that the whole Brexit conundrum, let's call it that, has thrown up is it's really sort of, you know, it's almost like we're having the debate after we've made a decision, which I think's quite interesting. But there's two things, isn't there, pulling this, I think. One is, you know, it's created uncertainty, i.e. we don't quite know what comes next. And for some people, that's quite a negative thing. But for other folks, it's a kind of, you know, it's a liberation in some ways, or it's a chance to sort of refresh, revise national kind of thinking or national identity. So how does the festival tackle those kind of things?
Well, I think just to answer your first question, I think uncertainty is something that is there despite Brexit. So I think we live in a world at the moment, as the philosopher who just died was explaining, a liquid society where, you know, there's no right or wrong, there's no really knowing what's coming next, and we just have to deal with that, I think, now. And all the problems we were told when we were born about if you have a degree in university, you'll get a job, that no longer is a rule. So, you know, I think the paradigm is changing, so we need to react to that. And Brexit is just, I think, a symptom of a larger thing that is really worldwide. And so we're just, I think, adjusting to it. And the festival tries to reflect that in the program and in the way it's conceived. So we have a program of visual arts that is on the theme of borders. We've had a German company who's been crossing the city from Ladywood to the Rep, throwing a single red line. So some of the people who are listening to this today might have seen in Brindley Place a red line crossing the square, red lines crossing living rooms, offices, toilets, under the cars, and going from an area that is deprived, joining that area with one of the most richest places in the city, trying to raise a question about you know, the inequalities we live in, and just to sparkle a conversation around that.
That's a very interesting concept, that kind of red line idea, because for me it kind of links, there's two things there that artist is trying to say. One is there are red lines in terms of things people will accept, or, you know, beyond points at which people are willing to negotiate. There's something also about, I think, it kind of is a nod towards this kind of this bureaucratic idea, you know, that kind of a lot of Europe, inverted commas, is a big bureaucracy. And I think what's interesting about that is part of what we're starting to discover, I'm using the royal we, what we're starting to discover, I think, in the UK is perhaps it's not just about markets and transactions. There's a lot more to it than that. There's a greater identity and a greater culture. And that's a very simple way, that kind of red line is a very simple way of exploring those concepts.
Yeah, what it's doing is reflecting on the absurdity of a border and how it's really a human conception. It's not necessarily, of course there are geographical borders, like the UK is an island, well, or part of the UK, so that is real. But some people would say that actually, some time ago, where boats were the main land of transport, actually going from Britannia to Britain was just very easy, and that was not a border at all. So borders are reimagined constantly, and the way our relationship to those borders changes constantly. So here at the festival we try to look at those, and at the moment as we speak there's been a conversation around the theme of borders with people from more than 25 countries being part of it. So it's fascinating to see all the perspectives on that, and how someone who comes from Albania will have a very different perspective to a border than someone who comes from Israel, and someone who comes from Scotland, or someone who comes from the south of England. The relationship to borders will be very, very different, and to the relationship with, as you were saying, bureaucracy that comes with borders.
Now, Birmingham is a very interesting place to find yourself in, particularly in this context, because in terms of the sort of nuts and bolts of the vote, in terms of the numbers, Birmingham was very finely balanced in terms of, I think, the majority to leave was about 50.6 or 50.4%, I think.
Yep.
It was very close. An interesting city to sort of platform. These kind of points, but this, you haven't chosen Birmingham for this reason. You have a long association with Birmingham, because I think you're based in Madrid, aren't you? Sort of.
We're based in Madrid half of the year, where we run a theatre company, and half of the year we're based here in Birmingham. We chose Birmingham, or I would say Birmingham chose us, because we came in 2009 to a conference, and the cultural sector was reflecting on the fact that there wasn't enough international work happening in the city. So we came up with the idea of creating an international theatre festival, which was very well received. And since we started and do it ourselves. And the festival has grown little by little each year. And we try now to expand beyond the theatre with projects like with the Red Line. And I think it's fascinating to be in a city such as Birmingham, with one of the youngest cities in the country, if not the youngest, I think. A very diverse city also. And the result of Brexit is just a reflection on what's happening in the rest of the country, because perhaps here it was yes by very little, but in other places it was no by very little too. So the country is divided, yes. Not only the city, and families are divided with that vote. And I hope that with time those divisions that now are so clear will slowly vanish, and we can just celebrate diversity, really.
Now, you've got quite a tough job as one of the directors of the festival. So yourself and Isla kind of have to put things together, have to kind of formulate the programme, and have to kind of make those hard decisions about what stays in and what stays out, if you like. I mean, how's that process changed? Because presumably when you started 8 years ago, perhaps you had, shall I say, a smaller pool to choose from. Now, I think, you know, you've got quite a following, isn't there, for the festival.
Yeah. So
when
how
do you do that? Do you throw everything up in the air and
we flip a coin. No, when we started the festival, we decided to open a call for artists to start with, because we had a very limited budget, but then, so it was a way to reach artists without traveling. Then we found that it was also a way to reach artists that don't access the normal circuits of programming. And so through the open call, we've managed to discover some gems, some artists that are unknown for the general public, but also for the programmers who are not following them. And since presenting the work at the festival, they've had a life afterwards, and they are performing in great venues across the world, really. So tonight we're presenting the second piece of a company called Kulunka from Spain, who've done three tours to China now, Brazil, Spain, all around Europe, anywhere. It's a big company now. And when they first presented their piece in 2011, the first piece, that it was one of the first places where they presented it. So it's great for that to happen.
And that's an interesting piece, isn't it? That's kind of solitudes.
That's
piece.
It. That's right. Yeah.
And that, to describe that, I can't really do it justice, but it's kind of like sort of human puppetry, I guess, in some ways. You've got
so the audience
masks.
Who listens to this has to imagine performers wearing a full mask that covers their whole head, as if the head would become a bit like a puppet, as you say. But then the way they act, they perform, is almost, I would say almost, because it's not quite, naturalistic. But of course, there's a theatrical element, which is the mask that brings a metaphor to what's happening. Of course, they're not speaking, because their mouths are covered. And so the show tells us what happens when there's no space for words anymore, when everything is being told, or when it's just before the words are needed. And so talking about a theme such as solitude, and especially when reaching an elder age, when you are alone at home, how do you react? When you're alone, how do you put a channel of TV and feel lonely?
Yeah.
And then how someone comes in at home and looks at you, and there's nothing else to say, because it's just by being there, is just everything is told. And yet they manage to, with this very sad theme in some aspects, to bring a lot of humor of the little miseries of human beings. So it's a wonderful show that I'm sure will be touring around the country
I'm looking forward to seeing it later on, and I think there's something very interesting about that idea, and something quite clever actually, because without language and without spoken word, it is perhaps focusing on very sort of human behaviour, human instinct.
Absolutely.
And that habitual sort of groove, if you like, that we fall into, which is common across, it doesn't matter whether you're Spanish, English or German.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to that one. I think that's going to be...
That's a common thread to the festival programme. We try to programme work that is accessible despite the country it comes from. So there's work that doesn't use any language. There's work that uses different languages in one piece. So yesterday we had a piece from Italy, but he was speaking in, I think, 5 different languages. We have work that uses surtitles in innovative ways. And we have work that, despite it having a text, the physicality is so strong that you can understand it.
The last thing I want to ask you about, and it's an important one, I think, is something that Bee Festival seems to do, which I'm not sure if it's the only place that does it, but it's certainly, I think, quite an innovative thing, is food. It does this properly. It has, sort of allotted time, if you like, for folks coming to the festival to sit down, have a meal together on the stage at the Rep, and kind of mingle and sort of meet each other and, have this wider dialogue. And I think, this isn't an exclusively mainland Europe concept, but it's something perhaps we in this country struggle to do sometimes, I think, to make that time for that kind of social element of the food.
Yeah, I guess in mainland Europe, especially in the southern countries, we do stop for lunch and we have an hour break, whereas here I found that my colleagues tend to grab a sandwich very quickly.
Yes.
and even have it while they're still working.
There's a great phrase, al desco. Have you heard that phrase?
No, I haven't.
To have your lunch at your desk.
Okay, al desco. Yeah, very good. That is a difference of culture, and I think doing it in the evening at least, and having an interval between the because we have 4 shows and either half an hour long each, and after the second one we have this hour-long interval, and having that interval allows us to create a space for exchange, where artists and audiences sit and meet, because there's no seats allocated, so people sit in long tables and encounters happen just with a glass of wine and breaking bread and sharing a big pot of salad. So kind of the encounter is very informal and very spontaneous. And then, of course, people are talking about the shows they've just seen. So the conversation is very easy to start with. And there's great stories, there's great atmosphere that happen during that time.
I think more festivals should build that in, because I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Now, just to finish, the festival, obviously, as we said, is in its 8th year, and presumably by the time you get to the end of this week, you'll be thinking about the 9th. You've got kind of ideas about what you might do next year?
Yeah, we've got a couple of shows already lined up from Czech Republic. A beautiful show that is called Light, using no light and just a projector with just lasers. So you only see the performers in certain moments. It's beautiful dance piece that we've been trying to bring for the last couple of years, and finally we've reached an agreement for next year. We will be having 2 artists from Germany exploring the theme of borders again. They are going to be doing some residencies over the year. They'll be part of the Birmingham Weekender in September, so check them out. They're called Stephanie Müller and Klaus-Erik Dild, and they're from Germany, and they'll be in the open markets on the Sunday 24th of September, and that will be like a little taster of what's to come for the next year.
That is an excellent thing, I think, to flag for people's diaries. Now, Miguel, I'm going to let you escape now into the finery of the remains of the festival. I'll be hanging around. I'm going to talk to some people later, hopefully, and ask them how they're finding it. But in the meantime, Miguel, thanks very much for your time. Thank you. Thanks.
For more information on the artists and performances at this year's Bee Festival, go to www.beefestival.org. Have you ever thought you need more time to play? Well, if you haven't, maybe you should. Future Makers is a summer programme of activities at MAC Birmingham designed to get you playing, making and building through open studio projects and exhibition space. I caught up with Alessandro Colombano from Birmingham City University's School of Architecture and Design to help make sense of it all.
I'm here hiding out in the exhibition space here at the MAC with Alessandro from Birmingham City University, who's going to help me, I hope, figure out the Future Makers programme of activity, really, rather than just an exhibition.
Yeah, it's kind of meant to be a programme which runs throughout the summer, which will kind of run across a number of levels. So one of them is a permanent exhibition, which will be up along the summer, and then there's going to be a programme of Future Makers alongside it, running alongside it.
And there's some key things it's based on, which I'm really interested to explore with you. One is playing, and defining playing is interesting, I think. Making and building. So I think probably with making and building, I've got a better steer. But are we talking about play and, I suppose, things people do outside of work? Is that?
There's quite a lot of kind of research going on at the moment in terms of adult play, the forms of adult play. But ultimately, with MAC's history and heritage and its kind of early years as an art centre which primarily dealt with bringing in the arts for young children, there's quite a natural fit with the idea of play with the venue. So also in my kind of day job as a senior lecturer at the School of Architecture and Design here, we often engage our students in a form of play. So when we ask them to design architectural projects or product design and so on, the students will be going through a design process, but fundamentally you can kind of break that down as a form of play.
So it's kind of using play as not just creative exercise but kind of an innovative kind of stimulus, is that the idea?
Yeah, because it's, you know, when you see a group of young kids playing, it's particularly interesting to see how they try and work things out, and they can be quite resourceful, and you know they think laterally. So if you kind of see a group of kids kind of building sandcastles on a beach, they're actually developing a lot of soft skills like you would do in an office or in any other kind of working environment.
There's a sense, I think, isn't there, as you grow older and you get older, and you know, all the wonderful things of life evolve, if you like. Yeah. You kind of, I suppose, you don't perhaps lose that ability to play, but you perhaps get less time to do it.
Yeah, and you know, it's just the nature of the way things are, that the arts are really under pressure in curriculum, primary and secondary education. And it was also under threat because of the recent kind of e-baccalaureate program that was proposed. But again, counter that, there is quite a lot of research happening at the moment with how creativity should be re-stimulated back into the curriculum, not just for arts and performing arts and so on, but in other subjects like geography, maths. And so Ken Robinson, He talks professionally now. He's a professional speaker, but does some amazing talks on TED.
He does, and he does a really interesting talk, I think, about losing creativity over time, doesn't he? So
yeah.
Listeners should check that out, I think, if you haven't come across that, because it is a really good.
Yeah, it's a really inspiring talk. You know, it's a TED talk, so it's quite succinct and in sound bites, but he's very good at kind of getting things across anecdotally. From his experience about how creativity can inspire people.
Now you're kind of leading the charge, as it were, of the Future Makers programme, but you've got a number of sort of artists, designers in residence, as it were, for the programme.
Yeah. We the Future Makers is quite a large team, and it's a project developed over 2 years, so it's 2 years in the making. Obviously, we've come across a number of people in that time. So there's myself, then there's Trevor Pitts, who initially came up with the kind of core concept of what future makers stem from. So he developed an idea called pavilions, which was about building pavilions in the park.
Now that's an interesting idea in itself, because people will instantly think of a kind of bandstand, don't they, or a kind of cricket pavilion or something like that. But do you want to just describe what we mean by pavilion?
Yeah, so a pavilion in an architectural sense, or as a designer, can mean any form of structure. And the reason why we use pavilions is because it's something relatively accessible in scale to build. It's a bit more manageable to build, and so therefore students can really test themselves, because they're not overwhelmed by producing something too big, and also the financial constraints. So pavilions kind of can be almost experimental construction structures.
And I guess there's something there that also kind of tests people's creativity in different places and different environments.
Yeah, and you see that with the Serpentine Pavilion in London. That's the kind of classic example. An architect each year is selected, and then they produce a design which then is built on in Hyde Park, and then is hosting a number of events over the summer.
Now the public themselves, you mentioned students, but the public themselves, folks that flow through the MAC on a daily basis, are kind of invited, very much invited to get involved and to make future things.
Yeah, so we're kind of sat now in the arena gallery. So as you enter the public foyer space, and so immediately you kind of see it. And because of the kind of the layout of the space, it's a very long and thin space. The way it's designed is to be a kind of like a production line. So not to say that design is a linear process, but actually there's a form of production, and there are lots of steps going on. So as soon as you enter, you see the open studio, where parents and kids and visitors are able to see what's been happening kind of first off, at first glance. Then you have a maker's studio, where the three residents and makers that you referred to before, they're kind of based there for 2 weeks at a time. They're testing ideas out, exploring things, they're pinning work up on the wall and making small maquettes.
And just to describe where we are at the moment in one of the kind of maker studio parts, if you like, it reminds me very much of my old kind of woodwork room at school.
Okay.
My old CDT, they called it when I was at school. So we've got things on the wall, we've got shelves to house things, but it's very sort of, I'm not going to say sparse, but it's very sort of clean, in the sense that you want people to sort of bring their ideas and manufacture their kind of their things here themselves. You know, it's not forced, is what I'm saying.
There are two ideas going on here at play. So firstly is the idea of opening up the design process, and actually, because myself in my job and my colleagues, we see it all the time in terms of getting our students to design and learn about design. But for people not in that industry or not in that sector or unaware of that, people like who stopped doing art at GCSE or even before that, they may not really understand or be aware about how does an artist make or how does a designer make. So the idea of kind of putting a production line, a creative production line in the gallery space, opening that up, is designed to make it more apparent. So that's the first idea. Then the second idea is about, at the moment it's a very clean space, and that's because we are in the changeover period of one maker to another. So last week the Jewel Works were in for 2 weeks, and this space was just full of maquettes and just early test models. And so once they finish their residency, they display their work in the test studio here, which we can see to the right. And then this maker studio gets reset, ready for the next maker. So the idea is that Simon and Tom Bloor will be filling this space up over the next 2 weeks with their own work.
So you've got that kind of continual process, which is part of the, I guess, the creative drive, but also it's quite a practical thing, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
you've got sort of, you're allowing people to come to the same space with all kinds of different ideas.
And I think ultimately it's about giving artists or makers or designers in this sense, or it can even be for school groups or for adults, it's just about giving them the right environment for them to work in. So that's what the design of the exhibition layout is all about.
And it's going to be, I believe, so we're already, I think two, maybe 3 weeks into the exhibition and the programme already. But at the end, there's going to be a kind of finale. There's going to be a show of kind of what everyone's achieved, what everyone's put together.
Yeah, so we've called that the big review. Again, I'm just borrowing from the design process that we use at higher education. It allows for future ideas to be kind of embedded or developing the ideas further. You know, it's a kind of question, what if? You know, what if this happened? So the big review is designed to, or organised to present all these ideas over the 6 weeks that the makers are in, along with the participating summer camps. We've also brought on board Emily Warner, who's a Future Makers participatory artist. Now, she's got a great experience in working with public groups to work with them and kind of share ideas and kind of look at stories, like the stories of their kind of life and so on.
Now, we're going to have a bit of a wander in a moment and hopefully going to point out some of the key bits of the exhibition or particularly things that we should be thinking about when we drift in. Okay, Alessandra, we're by the exhibition wall in the Future Makers exhibition in the Arena Gallery. Now, we're starting with this black and white image of what it looks like chaos. What's happening in this picture?
This picture is taken by Sven Turk, a Danish photographer from the 20th century. It's the old junk playground yards, and these were these started off in Denmark. And that word chaos is exactly what it is, and that's purposefully designed. And so, again, it's that idea of when you're looking at kids playing in, like, in the park or at a beach, they're still playing, but they're forming new skills.
So there's all kinds of things in the picture. There's a kind of an old, what looks like an old sewer pipe, and a very old motor car, and a kind of a hut and a tower and all kinds of things. It looks like an allotment that's sort of been shaken up a bit.
Yeah, so and that's exactly the point. And it's stuff that's been formed and created by the kids playing. And these became very popular because at that time there was obviously a lot of rubble after the Second World War. And so there were some early pioneers where they actually recognised that their kids had most fun when they were just kind of playing out in these junkyards, and that's where the junk playground work term came from. And it's quite interesting to see how people react to the exhibition, because not only is it the first image, but it's also the one that kind of captures people's imagination first off.
It's quite amazing how much stuff is in the photo, I think. It's quite an intricate image. I mean, I've just noticed right at the back there's a little girl making off with a tyre of some kind, and I've only just noticed her. And there's so much going on. It's quite a reflective image, isn't it? In the sense that it represents, I guess, what we're trying to achieve through the programme.
Yeah, and I think why it's so captivating now is because we can't really understand or we may not necessarily appreciate an environment where a lot of this kind of risk taking can happen, and it's hugely risky. There's loads of exposed materials, quite heavy, sharp objects, but yet, you know, it's still organised. The kids still kind of work around that, and they're able to use it to play with, and they've built these structures in that are in the photo. Quite often, we only see the final result, and actually, the stuff that happens before that and in between is often the most interesting too.
Well, that might be a good opportunity then to talk about the space that's behind us, which is the kind of studio space, which is, I guess, is a sort of demonstration of what you've just said, because it is, you know, it's still in flux, I think.
Yeah, and it's and it's going to remain in flux, hopefully, for the next kind of 6 weeks. And so the idea is that after the end of the 2 week residency for each maker, they then collate and curate all their artifacts, their ideas, their little scribbles. We try to keep it all and put it in the test studio in their allocated area. So they were looking at, they're using kind of basic plastic pipework with Corex sheets to make these portable structures which kind of wrap around your body, and so it kind of enclose you.
This to me looks like a deck chair in the wind.
Yeah, and it's lightweight and it's responsive to the elements and to the environment, and the idea is that, you know, we want people to the Mac, the building has a strong relationship with the park. So their idea was about creating structures which are portable, but get them to kind of explore the park whilst they're wearing them. And it's just interesting to see when we did take them out, what people's members of the public reaction were. Some of us looked a bit perplexed and was like, why are you doing this? And then others really engaged with it, and then they said, oh, we'll come back on the Saturday and, you know, kind of see how you're checking up on progress.
So I guess, you know, there's something there, isn't there, that links the sort of, I guess, you don't know how people are going to react to this. It's quite unpredictable. But it's quite an unpredictable process in some ways.
Yeah.
So it's quite a clever link, I think.
Maybe that's why it took quite a while to kind of get the project through to completion, is that we're making a very simple reversal with an exhibition. So normally an artist or designer will make a final product and it will be curated, perhaps with some information or maybe some test pieces in a very ordered way, curated in a very ordered way. Whereas here, what I was trying to propose is that we start with nothing. And so for an exhibition, that's actually quite hard to do. So you have to kind of try and design the space and that kind of right environment for that to flourish and happen. This kind of accumulation of stuff, you know, there's, because it is stuff at the end of the day, will just kind of grow and grow and grow.
Excellent. So Future Makers itself is on until the beginning of September?
Yes. So we're here with the makers in residence until the 18th of August, and then the exhibition continues until the 2nd of September, with the big review happening on the 30th of August.
That is excellent. I'm going to go and find myself a pavilion to hide under. But until I do that, Alessandro, thanks very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, another glowing highlight of this year's Bee Festival came in the shape of Foolish People's British Enough, an immersive, interactive experience that had participants pressed up against their own notions of nationality, reason, and identity. After a calming drink and a sharp intake of breath, I caught up with the key interrogators pushing the envelope closer to our shaking hands, and I started with Foolish People founder and writer, John Harrigan.
Okay, so I'm with John and Claire and Teresa from Foolish People. And you were the sort of antagonists, I'm going to use that word, behind British Enough, which I've described to other people as a kind of, I guess it's sort of interactive theatre.
Yeah, immersive theatre.
Immersive, that's a good word. And I experienced it myself earlier, and I think I'm still trying to come to terms with it. But John, do you want to start by sort of telling me about some of the buttons you're trying to press?
So, well, Foolish People have been creating immersive theatre for like 20 years now. We're one of the earliest companies in the UK to push this practice out. There are other companies, but we were the ones that have developed our own form of practice, which is called Theatre of Manifestation. And we work with text. All of our pieces are scripted, which is rare for the form. And this piece, British Enough, was a collaboration with an artist called Christina Cranfield, who is now a British citizen because she's taken the Britishness test. But it was a response to her films about how she experienced becoming British And what that meant to her. So basically, I took her films and then I wrote a piece of theatre, immersive theatre, that looked at what the tests in her films would be like in 70 years in the future. If we go along the lines of Brexit and all the things you're seeing happening in the media at the moment. So it was a response to that. So it's a quite hard piece of work that we're asking a lot of our audience.
Yeah, and to try and get listeners a kind of handle on the experience, which is difficult because I think you have to kind of go through it yourself. I would describe it as it's a kind of mix between being stuck at Heathrow Airport, being in a game show, and 1984.
That's a fair assessment.
Oh, okay, I must have got something from it.
So we were trying to offer our audience that this like experience of what it. Just a fraction of what it must be to be an immigrant, to feel that you're having to compete to become British. We like our audience being in a situation where they have to respond and think about how they feel about these things rather than passive. What we do is not passive in any sense. You have to engage.
Now, Claire, I'm going to come to you now because in some ways you're the scariest character, I think. Now, I mean that hopefully in a complimentary way. But the character that you take on mainly through this piece is a kind of officious bureaucrat. Is that a fair descriptor?
Absolutely, yes. She's doing her job, but she feels nothing. She's got to that stage where the people that come to her are just things. She feels contempt for them as well, but she's lost all heart. It's just tick box, tick box, tick box.
And there's a really interesting... I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't yet immersed themselves in it, but there's a really interesting part, I think, of the piece, where it starts, where we're made to kind of form an orderly box, essentially, to stay in a place and queue and be still and behave, you know, and kind of... These things are very British, but equally, you know, there's a sense of growing frustration and angst, thinking, oh, I want to go somewhere, I want to do something, that kind of thing. And Teresa, you don't get picked on, but I think you get sort of focused on, sort of perhaps more than anybody else. And it starts from that crowd. So I think what you did really well was there were lots of folks that perhaps didn't realise you were an actor. Which I think, is all credit to you, because people going, what's going on? What's happening with that woman over there? You know, that kind of thing. So how, for you approaching this, how easy is it for you to sort of keep that character when you're kind of attacked from each side, really, aren't you, I guess?
I would say that it's not difficult. It's quite easy. It's always good. We don't want to kind of give out more than necessary, especially in the beginning, because I think the character I embody, especially in the beginning, it's important to kind of make people believe that it's one of them, that they are in a very similar position or might be in a very similar position as she is. Of course, as the show kind of progresses, certain things happen. But I think that it is important because, I have lived in Britain for over 10 years. And it's not just part of Brexit, it's not actually just for people who are British, but it makes you question things that you haven't actually questioned yourself before, because suddenly you are not part of something, and it's not your decision, but it kind of influences how you feel. And I think in some ways, that's the way we want to make people feel. Suddenly it's out of their hands to decide if they are in or out. And they just need to respond.
So that's an interesting point, I think. And one thing that occurred to me was, and I think it's possibly in some of the literature as well, is that there's a sense in this that identity and your kind of national cultural identity, if you like, is something that can be gifted, that is something that you can be qualified and be given to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, it's more complex than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I completely agree. This notion that... it's like an inherited thing that you have to work for as part of being British. For me, certainly when Brexit happened and how things have been going in this country, that's not how I view Britain, because I'm a storyteller, so I'm very much connected to myths of Britain and old history. And Britain, I know, is a strange place that's had many forms of people go through it. So for me as a storyteller, immediately this stuff happened where all this... nostalgia for 70s and 80s, where what makes us British in the game shows, and that to me is, I think it's a great part of what makes people British, but the fact that that's all Britain is not how I see Britain. There's much more to it, much more deep. So yeah, that it was really dealing with that in terms of You know, what is that? What is that period? What does it mean to people?
One thing I noted in just talking to other people around the festival was that different people did different things throughout the performance. So there was separation, you know, a purposeful, you know, a group of people were taken away to a village fete, I think it was described.
Yes.
It was quite different from that.
Yeah.
The expectation was, oh, we're going to do something lovely.
Yeah.
And actually, it wasn't very lovely at all. I'll say that I wasn't entirely comfortable with sitting in a room putting a bag on my head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, to respond to that, what's interesting about that, Claire does it as part of the rehearsal. Sometimes I might be down there and she'll put a bag on my head. And when we arrived at BE Festival, she did it once and I was like, I loved it, and I was just answering, it was fun. And then she did it the next day and it was really quite a full-on experience. And even for me, she's very good at touching people's buttons when she does it and zoning in on something about you that you may not be aware of and repeating questions, so you start thinking. And it's a very challenging experience, but it's also very rewarding in how it makes you think about yourself. And I think good art, allows space for audience to have that experience. Obviously, there are variations of that, and ours is a very extreme variation, but you know, what I enjoy is something that makes me think, God, what does that mean to me? Who am I in relation to that experience? So that's really all, that's the basis of our work. That's almost the most extreme aspect of having a one-on-one with a performer and them asking you questions and what those questions mean for you.
Excellent. Now, the bags themselves, again, I don't want to give too much away, but were different colours, I noted. One black during interrogation, red during the kind of failure celebration, let's call it that. There was a celebration of failure,
yeah,
wasn't there,
yeah,
at the end?
It was a celebration.
Which looked like, I felt, I haven't felt like this for a long time, but at my sixth form disco, where I was uncomfortably on the fringes, thinking, yeah, oh, who am I going to dance with?
Yeah.
Oh no, somebody old is trying to dance with me.
Yeah,
and a very British thing as well. Very,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very
uncomfortable.
In.
Yeah. Like, what stops? Because it's really, again, even though I was dancing, that's because this is my performance space and I can do that. When I go out, I feel that same thing. You know, it's an awful British feeling. Like, should I dance? If you're at a wedding, I can't engage with it. But, and I'm interested in that for our audience. Why can't they release? Why can't they just, you know, just have that fun and of just to dance? What stops us? In especially in that experience, because our buttons have been pushed, we go into like protection mode. But when Kate says at the end, it's just a game. This is just a game. We're all playing a game in one way or another. And then there's the release. We offer our audience the release. It's like, will they take that? Will they not? It's the same with the hoods. Will you put a hood on? Will you not? And we love. It's difficult when people don't want to put a hood on because maybe they won't have the same experience. But we do like it when audience push back. That we would absolutely not be what we are if we didn't. We haven't had years when all kinds of things have happened where audience really challenge us as much as we challenge them. So, for example, in past shows, Lucy has been on stage in a situation and people have gone onto the stage to try and rescue her because they felt so compelled. Or, for example, Teresa today, a girl, when she picked Teresa in the first cycle to, you know what happens to her, after upstairs in the dance, just started sobbing and sobbing and had to go over to Teresa and apologise profusely because of what it brought out in her, the fact that she did pick Teresa.
Well, it's interesting. I was going to pick up on that because it's interesting. What I found fascinating was that kind of peer pressure aspect. We had a group of people experiencing the same sort of thing. And clearly there were a lot of people thinking, I'm not very comfortable with this, I'm not very happy about it. But not really going the next, you know, move. And I think part of my kind of frustration, I guess, and why I sort of, you know, started getting a little bit, let's say, stroppy, let's call it that, was I felt very protective towards
That's
you.
Yeah.
And
so
I thought,
you should.
And you were standing very close to me here, and I thought, my instinct was to put my arm around you or to hold your hand.
Yeah.
And even though there's this thing, and I was kind of thinking, yeah, I'm on a kind of bit of a balance here. You know, I kind of don't quite know what to do.
That's a really good thing.
That's a good thing. Yeah. Yeah, really
that's
good.
A good thing, but also it kind of is a reflection of the real world, isn't it? It's because sometimes we are moved by something, but for different reasons, we decide not to actually step into a situation that we think is uncomfortable or embarrassing or hurtful to someone. So again, it is a reflection, where is the border where you pretend that nothing bad is happening and when you actually have to react, how you react, when is for you okay to say, well, what I witnessed was not real, because was it or was it not?
One of the things that struck me about the piece was that Britishness and Englishness were interchangeable, okay? And in fact, I don't think you ever use the word English throughout.
No, we don't.
Which is quite interesting because some of the examples, some of the things that you referred to, I would perhaps consider very English things.
Yeah.
Now, if I was a Scotsman, and I'm not, or if I was Welsh, I'd be standing there thinking, wow, what is all of this kind of
thing? Yeah.
And it tells me, I suppose I get to a point where I kind of think part of the sort of anxiety and the angst we're going through at the moment is we haven't really properly defined what that British
absolutely.
Thing is.
Absolutely. No, I 100% agree with you on that. The fact that, that this Britishness is just automatically is English-centric rather than, because my dad was from Paisley in Scotland and we've got lots of people within the company from various areas, and I can so agree with that. But again, for Englishness, for me, even though I love the 70s period, and a big part of our work is that strange 70s things like Chocky and all those beautiful, unusual programmes on the BBC, that for me, it's Albionic. The history goes far further back. It's so interesting. And I don't see Britishness or Englishness even as the, from, you know, the 60s to the, wherever you want to take it from. You know, my mum grew up in the war. So, I have a really tenuous relationship with what Britishness is and how it's represented in the media.
I would also like to add, there is quite one interesting aspect, isn't it? It's the same as a person, you can have a self-perception, but other people have actually perception from outside, and I think it actually does apply to nations. And it's one of the topics we actually talked about, because it was interesting for me, being a foreigner, even though I have lived in Britain for a long, long time, that I perceive Britishness as something completely different than people who are born in Britain.
So what's next for Foolish People?
We work in feature film as well, so we've done two features, which is one in Prague, which was interesting, as Englishmen making a film there with our team, and the second one is part of this work. We started a Borderland year, which was up when Brexit started, and the first film is about England and about what it means to be English. So it's almost a companion piece, not quite like this. It's not modern in this sense, but it is very much linked to the same notion of what is British and what does it mean to us, and it deals more with King Arthur and things like that.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to wish you well.
Thank you so much for coming.
So
and
much.
I'm going to watch with interest what you do next.
Thank you very much.
So
John, Claire, Teresa, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And now it's time to close the box. You can check out our blog for more links and information at www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. Our next show airs on the 30th of August. My thanks to The Rep Birmingham, Foolish People, Miguel A. Anthon and all at B Festival, Mac Birmingham and Future Makers. Title music by Morgan TJ. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio.